on this edition of Celebrating Science, Michael Belfiore on Rocketeers and the Race to Privatize Space. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation.
My name is John Matlock. I'm the Director of External Relations and Outreach at Perimeter Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you and to welcome everybody tuning us in from around the world. Tonight's lecture, Rocketeers, how a visionary band of business leaders, engineers, and pilots is boldly privatizing space. We'll explore the dream-chasing entrepreneurs and clever engineers who are blazing new trails into the heavens and preparing the world for an era of space tourism, ultra-fast point-to-point Earth travel, and even orbiting hotels. Now, it wasn't that long ago when these sorts of private craft were thought of as science fiction. And to prove the point, we want you to watch how this space plane, this rocket, and this space station morph into what some people are calling the modern-day Thunderbirds. What you'll see tonight aren't exactly the Thunderbirds, but the people who are building them maybe have some of that same spirit. And the person who's met them is Michael Belfiore, our guest speaker for tonight. Michael has written about the private space program since the launch of Spaceship One, which he covered for the New York Post. And since then, he's written science articles for Reuters, Wired.com, Popular Science, and New Scientist. He is also author of the popular blog, Dispatches from the Final Frontier, and his editorials have appeared in the Financial Times and other publications. Michael's other writing projects have involved everything from biographical materials on former astronauts to the children's book, Life Aboard a Space Station. His latest project, Rocketeers, is the first book to fully chronicle the private space program, and he captures a real sense of the individuals who are making it happen. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Canada, Michael Belfiore.
Hi, thanks for coming. I wrote this book because I had a dream. I'd always wanted to be an author, and I grew up reading science fiction. I thought that was the best, science fiction. People talking about what we're going to do in the future. The problem was I came along after the Apollo moon program, and it looked like the future that the science fiction talked about that I read wasn't really going to happen. And that was pretty disappointing to me. And but a few years ago, I started hearing about people building their own spaceships, just like the science fiction I used to read. People building their own spaceships. And specifically, they're competing for a prize, $10 million, first team that can get a spaceship built and send themselves up into space, $10 million. Well, I decided to seek these people out and find out what they were doing and see just how crazy they were and chronicle the winning of the X Prize. And the problem was, by the time I figured out to do that and went around trying to find these people, the X Prize was already being won. So the book became about how did this crazy prize come together and how did it get won and what are they doing now? We need to go back a little bit and see what these folks are working in opposition to. Space 1.1, right? Most people are pretty familiar with this concept that the government, whether it be the Russian government, Canadian government, United States government, the government, in big words, is the in big letters, is the one that has to build spaceships. You got to have lots and lots of money, and lots of engineers, and you got to spend a lot of time. It didn't start out that way, though. It started out with a bunch of amateur rocketeers in, well, in this case, Germany. This is Wernher von Braun, who became the father of the American moon program. And he started out as just an amateur guy working with a bunch of guys in fields, you know, build stuff together, maybe no bigger than I am, launch them off. And the German government came along, thought that was a pretty good idea, and they brought these people together in a place called Peenemünde, and they built rockets to bomb the Allies with. After the war, they came over to the United States, and they started working at a place called the Redstone Arsenal in Huntsville, Alabama, and still in relative obscurity. But not to the people in Huntsville, Alabama. These people were just so excited to have this event happening in their town. They called it Rocket City. And things were pretty quiet until this happened. October 4, 1957, the Russian government put up a satellite. And it's the first time anyone had done this, and the U.S. government was just completely blown away by this. They thought, oh my, this is horrible, it's the end of the world, the sky is falling. What are we going to do? Well, we got these guys in Huntsville. Let's see what they can do. So they put Wernher von Braun and his guys to work. Now, this guy had always wanted to go to the moon. That was his dream. So he would do this. He'd work for anyone who'd give him the money and the people to do this. So that's what he's going for. The U.S. government was thinking, well, we just put a big rocket, put some munitions on top, and we could throw it over there. Well, von Braun said, well, take off the munitions, put a guy in there. So that's what they did. They have a missile. Well, the guy on top. And they just made these things bigger and bigger. And look at this thing. You can't get a sense of the scale. I was there recently. This is the test stand where they test fire the Saturn rockets. And this is unbelievable. But it's still just big missiles. Meanwhile, the Air Force in California had this whole other idea how we're going to get to space. We're going to build airplanes, put rockets in them. And this is where Chuck Yeager came in, broke the sound barrier in the 50s with a rocket-powered airplane. And they just kept building onto this idea. Let's make the planes bigger. Let's put bigger rocket engines in them. Let's make them go higher and faster. And this program culminated in the X-15. This was actually the United States government's first spaceship. Thing went up into space, had little thrusters on it, and you can maneuver up there, come back down, land on a runway. You didn't have to build a missile. This thing launched from the bottom of a B-52 bomber. The pilot in the X-15 would give the signal and say, okay, I'm ready, boys, and they would drop him off. He'd go into free fall and hit the rocket, light it off, and away he'd go. And look at that, that's Neil Armstrong. He started out in this space program before he walked on the moon. You can see the thrusters right here. This is how he'd maneuver in space. I mean, you're not talking about going into orbit. Just go right up out of the atmosphere, hang out up there, and maneuver around, get yourself reoriented for reentry, and then come back down. Now, this thing had to fly a very precise trajectory to land properly. That was one of its big drawbacks. In fact, one of the pilots wiped out on this thing because he came in at the wrong angle. The ship flew apart in the aerodynamic forces going at a high Mach number, and he didn't survive. Still, this was a totally reusable system. They could have kept building it up and getting farther and faster, and the world would be a very different place today if this had allowed to continue this development instead of going bang right over to these missiles with guys on top. But we had to beat the Russians, right? So this is the result. It's the Saturn V moon rocket. This is the most powerful rocket ever to fly. This thing has 7.5 million pounds of thrust, 36 stories tall. You could take 9 city buses and stack them up in there and blast them off to pass the speed of sound. It's really hard to imagine the power of this thing and what it, I mean, because I wasn't born yet, what it must have felt like to stand there and feel this thing thundering in your chest. But here's the curious thing. Here's the thing about this. See, they're separating the stages right there. Boom! They're just throwing away how many millions of dollars just like that. It's one shot, one-time use. And see that again? There it goes. The only thing that comes back is a little bitty capsule on top with the guys in it, and that doesn't get reused. So it's very, very expensive. And the thing is, this is how they did it. And so it became accepted wisdom, this is how you have to get to space. And it also became accepted wisdom, you've got to spend lots of money, and you got to have these big throwaway rockets, and it's only going to be a very, very few people who get to actually do this. And this is what makes it all worthwhile. This picture has been credited with starting the environmental movement, because this is the first time in 1968, when the astronauts took this picture on Apollo 8, this was the first time people on Earth could see themselves in perspective. They could see their place in the universe. And it was an amazing thing. 1968 was, it was a really tough time. Riots going on, political assassinations, Vietnam War was going on. But this picture came back, and the astronauts got a telegram afterwards that said, guys, you saved 1968, because this happened Christmas 1968. And that was it. That was what the Apollo program was designed to do. Get up there, land on the moon, put a few flags up. I mean, I'm not putting it down. I mean, it's an amazing, incredible thing. But it was designed for one purpose, which was to beat the Russians at any cost. And it turned out to be a very large cost. After that, President Nixon said, you know what? I think we're done with this thing. We got to figure out what to do with this war. And a lot of engineers, a lot of pilots, a lot of astronauts were incredibly disappointed. And the space shuttle came along about 10 years later, and it didn't have a clear purpose. Von Braun had this idea that we'd build space stations in orbit, and we'd build a shuttle to go up there and service it, and then from there we'd build our ships to go to the moon and onto Mars. But what happened was the shuttle came along too late. There was no space station at that time. It was very expensive to launch because even though it was a winged vehicle that could return, it threw away this giant external fuel tank. So we still are stuck with very, very expensive systems, much of which is thrown away on launch, still without a way for large numbers of people to go into space. This is where we get to space 2.0. So enough of these people like me grew up with this idea that, hey, we're going to go to space, and it's just not just like the sort of collective we, but we, you and me, we're going to go to space. And it didn't happen. And so a lot of these folks had grown up, and some of them made a lot of money, and they thought, you know what? The government's not going to do this. I'm going to do it. So that's where a guy named Peter Diamandis came along. He wanted to be an astronaut. Well, he found out that probably you have one chance in 1,000 if you want to hook up with an astronaut corps somewhere that would actually have a chance to go to space. You have one chance in 1,000 to actually join that astronaut corps. And then you'd probably fly a desk for about 10 years, and maybe you'd get one space shuttle flight. So he thought, this is ridiculous. We got to do something about this. So he started this prize, the X Prize, $10 million. The first team send 3 people into space. Now, that was crucial to him. He wanted not just one test pilot. He wanted one pilot and 2 passengers, 2 people who had no job, just sit there and enjoy themselves. Then you got to bring them back, right? Obviously, that's crucial. Then you got to do the same thing again in 2 weeks with the same vehicle. Now, that was like totally mind-blowing because, well, we'd seen those big Saturn rockets, all the stuff flying off and everything. No, we can't have that. If we're going to have routine operation to space, we got to have the same vehicle. I mean, it's like if you took a 747 and flew it across the Atlantic for one flight and then just threw it in the ocean afterwards. I mean, the ticket price, I worked it out, I think it's something like $100,000 a ticket or something. So the XPRIZE got started in 96. These are some of the guys who are competing for it. They're from a team called Armadillo Aerospace. They're about to launch something from the back of their pickup truck there. And there he is up close, John Carmack. He actually programmed the game Quake and Doom. And he took that money and he put it into his own little private space program. And as a hobby, they get together Tuesday nights. They're still going at it, Tuesday nights and Saturdays. If you ever go down to Dallas, Texas, look him up, and he'll probably invite you to the shop. And that's what's really cool about these little private companies. You can actually call them up. I mean, I'm nobody special. I just wanted to find out about these guys. And I said, hey, John, can I come hang out with you? And he said, well, okay. And And that's Peter Diamandis over here. He founded the XPRIZE. And look at this guy. I love this guy. That's Tim Pickens. He grew up in Huntsville. His dad worked on the Apollo moon rockets, and he just took it for granted when he grew up he's going to work on rockets too. But he grew up, and as he described it to me, he said, it was as though a bunch of aliens came here, built a bunch of cool stuff, and then all left. There were no jobs. Rocket City wasn't Rocket City anymore. So he's like, well, I guess I better do it myself. And he built himself a rocket-powered bicycle. He says this thing can go 0 to 60 in about 10 seconds. And that's why he's wearing a helmet, because he said he got this bike on sale at Walmart. And he's a little worried about what it might do at 60 miles an hour. But you can see off of here, this is the ignition wire that goes inside that's roofing tar in there. And he's got a switch on here, and nitrous oxide is flowing into here. And he's got a little model rocket engine like you get at the hobby store as the igniter. And he just hits that switch, he hangs on for dear life, and if for some reason he doesn't hang on anymore, it's a dead man switch, cuts off the nitrous flow, the engine shuts off. Great stuff. That's Brian Feeney. He's Toronto's very own space program. He ran a company called Da Vinci Project. His goal was to fly himself into space. He doesn't have any pilot training. He's not an engineer. But he wanted to do this thing. And he got all these engineers from all over the world to contribute, to volunteer their time and effort. I went and visited his shop. This is in 2003. He was the first guy I actually hooked up with. Because I remember I called up John Carmack. Actually, what he said was he didn't say OK at first. He didn't know who I was. He had no idea what I was doing. And he didn't want me in there until I had some sort of track record. Brian Feeney said, come on over. So I got on a plane, came to Toronto, and you know, I owe him a debt of gratitude because he believed in me. And this is what this is all about to me, this idea of believing in a dream and carrying it through. It's incredibly inspiring. And there he is. He let me saw some things in the shop and had me sign my name on it, and I had no idea what it was, but I thought, boy, that was really cool. And he's still working. He didn't win the XPRIZE, but he's working on this thing. This is the XF1. He says he's going to roll out this vehicle at the end of next month. And this is a one-seat spaceship. He said he can get to space by the end of this year. We'll see, right? This is another Canadian project, also in Ontario. This is a Canadian Aero. They took von Braun's original plans for the V2 rocket that they bombed the Allies with, and they said, that's pretty good design. Let's take the munitions off and put guys on top. And so now that group is called Planet Space, and actually these guys are now very seriously being considered for NASA funding as a way to supply the space station. Not with this vehicle. They have another partnership, actually, with Lockheed Martin. It's an enormous supplier of, well, munitions, but rockets. And these guys are another group. You see the size, to scale. This is the full size market. And this is what it's all about, really. This to me, which it's inspiring young people to have these dreams and to. This is Terry Wong, and he's here in Ontario, and he's one of the he's a pilot, and he's one of the potential astronauts to go on this ship. And kids get really fired up about this stuff, and they think, well, wow, look, these guys are doing this. Maybe I could do this. And, you know, get the bugs worked out first. But okay, so this is the ship that won the XPRIZE. This is Spaceship One. This is actually two ships. This looks like some kind of crazy insectile thing. It's really typical of the design of this guy who designed this, Burt Rutan. He started out in his garage building a fighter plane out of plywood. And I'm serious. And you can see this plane actually flying in the movie Death Race 2000. So if you get that movie, it's on Netflix. I just got the movie and I watched that one part over and over. And it's fun to listen to the director's commentary, too, because the director's like, this some crazy guy built this thing in his garage, and I had to have it in my movie. And so this is one aircraft, and this is this spaceship. So they have identical cabins. You can't really see here, but you can just see the pilot's arm sticking out. He's waving to the crowd. There's a little plug right here that he would equalize pressure with. He'd just pull this plug out when he got back from space. And two jet engines right here, and this carrier airplane takes this guy up to altitude, drops him off, just like Chuck Yeager and just like the X-15. Burt Rutan was an engineer working at Edwards Air Force Base when the X-15 was flying. So he was inspired by the X-15. He thought, let's get rid of all these munitions with guys on top. Let's go back to basics. Let's get winged airplanes that we can take off and land and reuse. So that's what he did. And here's a little video of it in operation. Here, he drops off, just goes into free fall right here, lights the rocket engine, and just pitches up. It's just a stick. He just pulls back that stick and hangs on for dear life. One of the pilots called it riding the bull. He's going Mach 3, faster than a rifle bullet. There's the Virgin logo. Oh, see, now you see this spinning around here? He's actually spinning really fast, and that wasn't supposed to happen. But there's no question this is a risky endeavor. But these guys did this. They built Spaceship One and White Knight for $25 billion. And that's incredible. You think about the space shuttle costs $500 million to launch. Admittedly, okay, they're going all the way to orbit with the shuttle. But this only goes straight up out of the atmosphere, quick look around. But look at this view. I mean, that's what it looks like. You're not up to orbital altitude. You're about half the altitude, about 100 kilometers. The standard recognized definition of space. So the XPRIZE insisted you had to go to 100 kilometers. And you can see the edge of the atmosphere. The black sky during the day is just apparently an incredible thing to behold. One of the pilots, the guy who was spinning, he described looking through the windows and just seeing the blue sky just turn black like this. And looking down, both of these guys are not given to poetic description, but they both were fundamentally changed by this experience. Mike Melville, the guy who we saw spinning around, he said it was like touching the face of God. He really felt this spiritual thing. And when I saw him come back, he actually jumped out of the airplane. He's 63 years old. He's jumping up and down like a little kid going, that was amazing! And Brian Binney, who took this picture, said it was like stepping into another realm, just this blessed, peaceful realm, unlike anything else he had experienced, and he's weightless at this point. And there's Brian flying the Stars and Stripes. He's actually from Scotland. It's October 4, 2004. The XPRIZE was won. They completed the second of their two back-to-back flights. And that's October 4. That's the anniversary of Sputnik. So there's another important milestone on October 4. And you can just make out the tail number. This is N328KF. That stands, well, N is the, any airplane has that N designation. But then 328K, 328,000 feet, is 100 kilometers. And the F stands for feet. This is Mojave, California. I'm proud to say I took that picture. And that's where Spaceship One is now. It's hanging in the Air and Space Museum, Washington, D.C. And look at all these great milestone, epoch-making planes. This is the Spirit of St. Louis right here. The orange one up top, that's Chuck Yeager's plane. He broke the sound barrier in. The nose sticking out here is the X-15. And that's the Apollo 11 command module that sent the first people to walk on the moon. So, what are they doing now? Well, here's the video game guy, Armadillo Aerospace. Well, didn't win the XPRIZE, but he's still building these things. Most of these are taken in the parking lot outside their workshop. He says that he puts enough of these rocket motors together, he can get all the way to orbit. Tuesday night, Saturdays, these guys got it going on. Here's X-Corps Aerospace. They're just down the flight line at the same airport as Scaled Composites and Burt Rutan's company that built Spaceship One. Look, they've got a rocket-powered airplane. And you see that a little closer up. This is actually a Burt Rutan design, the guy who designed Spaceship One. He got his start making plans for other people to build their own airplanes. Started out with the one in his garage. He said, hey, maybe I can give plans for other people to do this. So this is one of his plans. It's called the Easy, the Long Easy. So these guys built the Easy rocket. They took the propeller out. It was in the back, and they stuck two rocket engines in there. And who would they get who's crazy enough to fly that thing? That's Rick Searfoss. He's a former space shuttle commander. Incredible guy. He's like total right stuff, test pilot guy. And you can see his Mach 25 club. The guys who fly in the shuttle, they go Mach 25. So they have these patches, Mach 25 club. And so he's flying with X-Corps now. He left the government. He said, well, I don't think the government is the future in space travel. He says, I'm going to go to the private sector. So he's the chief test pilot for X-Corps Aerospace, and they're building something. They won't let me see it. They have it draped off in their workshop. Oh, yeah, I can't see that. But this guy's working there, and he thinks they're his ticket to space. I just love that clip. I could just watch that all day. That's great. That's one of their most recent projects. It's a methane-powered rocket engine. The idea is you could get to Mars and manufacture methane out of the atmosphere for a return trip. But they might just actually send some people up into space with a motor like that. Who is this guy and why is he so happy? That's Jeff Bezos, who runs Amazon.com. And he's so happy because he built this. He's got his own space program. This is one of the most hush-hush, top-secret private space programs. He won't let anyone see what's going on, except for this. He has a website up. You can see this photo. BlueOrigin.com. You just put up this post and say, oh, yes, we're building rockets. If you're an engineer, we need you. Everyone else, stay out. And that's what you do, trying to recruit engineers to come and build this thing. It's going to take tourists into suborbital space. And let's see this thing.
Stand by for terminal four. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You know what's cool about this? There's no flame coming out of there. It's a hydrogen peroxide. We think. He's not telling anyone, but sort of the idea is that probably it's hydrogen peroxide. It's a monopropellant. You don't need a separate oxidizer, oxygen, or nitrous oxide. Just one thing, and it produces this flameless.
This is a 2,700-pound thrust hybrid rocket engine.
Now, that's Tim Pickens again. That's the rocket bike guy. And what happened between the rocket bike and this is and that's me interviewing him in Huntsville. He stayed in Huntsville, and Burt Rutan went shopping for a rocket engine for Spaceship One. And he thought, well, Huntsville's Rocket City, let me go there. And he interviewed with a bunch of companies and wasn't impressed. And this guy, Tim Pickens, managed to work for about half of them. So everywhere Burt Rutan went, there was Tim Pickens. And showing him around they sat at one point at a conference room, this place called Space America, and the president was very proud. He stuck in his tape, and he's like, here, I want to show you one of our new rocket engines. Stuck it in there, and this thing lit up and just exploded, just boom, bits of metal flying everywhere, and just this horrible fireball, and Tim Pickens likes to describe, his eyes got as big as saucers, Burt Rutan he's talking about. And Burt Rutan was just like, I can't put a pilot in that thing, he just killed my pilot. So Tim took him aside and he said, well, you know, you might want to try a hybrid rocket motor. And this guy's working with liquid propellants. And he said, hybrid rocket is solid propellant and a liquid oxidizer. This is basically asphalt and nitrous oxide, just like on his rocket bike. In fact, he took him around to his garage and he showed him my rocket bike. And Bert Rutan was really impressed. Remember, this is the guy who got started building a fighter plane out of plywood in his garage. He sees this guy building a rocket in his garage, and he saw the possibilities. And he was most impressed by the fact that Tim would actually put his own behind on top of his rocket. He had that much confidence in it. And he could do it over and over, and it wouldn't blow up. So he said, why don't you come work with me, and we'll build a spaceship. And Tim thought that sounded like a good idea. And after that, he came back to Huntsville and started Orion Propulsion. And so he's showing me his latest creation here.
This is a 2,700-pound thrust hybrid rocket engine. It uses nitrous oxide, and it's actually roofing tar as the fuel. If you'll come over here, I'll show you a fuel grain of actual asphalt. We'll show you what's inside that hybrid rocket motor.
Uses a solid fuel, which is in the center case here.
He actually built this for his pickup
an
truck.
Asphalt-based fuel. We've got an oxidizer tank.
He's working for a customer right now doing a test, so he didn't want to be too public about it.
Sensors
at the time.
On this nozzle.
He thought it'd be great. Stick that thing in his pickup and blow somebody away at a stoplight.
To get a different temperature gradient.
The shower head sets right here.
He said, I'll show you some noise right here.
And the oxidizer comes in. Basically, there's a torch setting here. Provides a lot of heat. Oxidizer comes in, decomposition of the nitrous, the burning takes place, and the nozzle's on the other end here. Of course, you've seen what happens after we light it. You don't have to have that explained to you.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Oh, man. So here's Elon Musk. He made the cover of Inc. magazine, December issue. Co-founded PayPal, building the coolest car ever, ready to colonize Mars. And that's what he's doing. He made a lot of money selling PayPal to eBay, and he really wants to go to Mars. And but what's really cool about what he's doing is he's taking the little steps. He's saying, okay, some guys are already doing suborbital space, Spaceship One, it's already happened. Let me go to the next level. Okay, let me build something that'll throw a satellite up there. And let me recover the stages that come off it and reuse them, reuse the engines so we don't have to throw everything away. And if I can do that and build these things cheaply enough, then I can undercut the market by, you know, a third. I could build and launch these things for a third of the nearest competitor. So he's out in California. A lot of these guys seem to be in California. Well, he's actually from South Africa. And you'd never, I mean, this guy is the most unassuming guy. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He works in a cubicle, just like the rest of his employees, at SpaceX. That's the name of his company, Space Exploration Technologies. Got some video of one of their tests. After they gave this to me, they were a little disappointed. They said, don't you want one that doesn't rattle around so much? And actually, they didn't have any. This thing is so powerful. I got to sit in the control room when they were test firing this thing. And they have to throw out this big deluge of water so it doesn't melt down the concrete when the engine fires. And they're out in this Texas plain. They have this Texas test facility. And this enormous font of flame just blasts out into the Texas prairie. And they call it mowing the grass. And you see buzzards flying around, you know, because it just blows away everything in there, out there. That's what it looks like close up. That's the Merlin engine. And that was built, well, it started out as something in someone's garage. This guy, Tom Mueller, was an amateur rocketeer and also worked for a defense contractor in California. And Elon Musk went to an amateur rocket club in California, and he asked around, and everyone told him, you got to talk to Tom Mueller. He is the biggest liquid-fueled, amateur-built rocket engine ever. in his garage. And so Elon went and looked at it, and he said, can you build me something bigger? And he said, sure. So they're building these things, and they're putting them on assembly lines. And Musk compares himself to Henry Ford. He says, well, Ford didn't develop the automobile. He just figured out how to make it cheaper. And that's sort of what he's doing. He's taking an old technology like this, figuring out how to make it cheaper. And they've had many successful test firings of this engine. They've already built the rocket. That's the Falcon 1 rocket. It's going to send satellites up hopefully this year. And hopefully also this year they're going to test fire and fly the Falcon 9. Now, this has one Merlin engine on the bottom. Falcon 9 will have 9 of them. And they're going to fire it off on this test stand they call the BFTS. And I sort of figured, okay, I know what you're talking about. And he said, no, that's the Big Falcon test stand. This guy is just amazing. All of these guys are amazing. He's a Las Vegas real estate developer, Robert Bigelow, and he grew up as a kid watching atom bomb blasts from his schoolyard in Las Vegas. I can't imagine what that would do to a kid. And also, when he was about 3, his grandparents encountered aliens. And so they said, and it was the family story, and everyone believed it. I mean, the grandparents believed it, and Bigelow believed them. And they said they were driving down a desert highway, classic story, middle of the night, this giant thing comes flying toward the car, lit up like a Christmas tree, and just as it's about to hit them, it veers off at a right angle, much, much faster than anything humans could build would do. So Bigelow grew up with these two ideas in his head. One, that we're not alone in the universe, and two, that we're about to blow ourselves to smithereens. And he thought, you know what, we got to get out there. We got to make friends. We have to mature as a species. So he's like 15 years old. He decides, you know what, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to help humanity reach the stars. He didn't know how he was going to do it. He just knew it would take a lot of money. So he went into real estate in Las Vegas, and he made lots and lots of money. And then he amassed several $100 million and around 2000, 1999, 2000, he looked around and thought, okay, I think I'm ready. And then he told his wife, oh, by the way, the whole reason I'm doing this is because I want to build my own space program. And she said, really? He didn't tell anyone, not even his wife. And she said, well, okay, well, just don't spend all of it. And what he has done is truly amazing. He has built, this thing is in orbit right now, that's a Bigelow space station module of 25% scale, has all the systems that would go on a full-size space station with people in it, but it's much smaller. He's got 2 of these in orbit right now. This uses a kind of interesting technology where the thing launches compressed, almost like a roll of paper towels or something. And it's made of flexible fabric instead of rigid metal. And it launches, and the advantage of this configuration is you can launch a much larger eventual volume in a smaller package. They use the same size rocket to launch something that eventually gets much bigger. So the upshot is that these things were going to be bigger than anything on the International Space Station. It's about the size of a 3-bedroom house. And they're bulletproof, too. They actually fired projectiles at them at bullet speeds, and they didn't penetrate, which is something the rigid metal space stations can't do. And incidentally, this started as a NASA program, this inflatable technology. It was canceled. And the mock-ups they had built were cut up and thrown away, and the engineers were let go. And Bigelow came along around 2000, and he thought, you know what? This is my opportunity. And he bought the entire program. He acquired the patent rights to build this stuff, and he got the engineers together. And he created a 50,000-square-acre research and development facility outside of Las Vegas. And he's going to fly a full-size module by 2010, he says, and I think he might just do it. That's time-lapse. It doesn't really go that fast, but you get a kind of a sense of it. in orbit. And this is what's flying around inside one of these modules. These are things that people sent in. For $295, you could send Robert Bigelow a picture or a golf ball or, I don't know, an Elvis head bobble. And you'd have it, and you could see it on his website, BigelowAerospace.com. I have an early version of my book cover up there. I think just like going to see Spaceship One launch and being able to see Mike Melville jump out and jump up and down like a little kid and then get his autograph afterwards, this provides a very personal connection with space that I don't think you've ever had an opportunity to experience during any of the government space programs. So this is Burt Rutan today, just 2 weeks ago, actually. The guy who built Spaceship One, 2 weeks ago he unveiled to the press and the public his new design. Look at this crazy thing. It's got, well, I'll show you, you'll see it, another picture of it. This is his financier, Richard Branson. He owns the Virgin Group of companies, this guy here, and Virgin Atlantic Airlines, and now Virgin America, now Virgin Galactic. And he saw Spaceship One, he was so inspired by it that he thought, you know what, I gotta get in on this action. He hired Burt Rutan to build Spaceship Two. This guy sitting in front of him, he's the first guy to win frequent flyer miles to space. 2 million frequent flyer miles on Virgin Atlantic gets you a ride to space. And this is a mock-up of what it's gonna look like inside, and you'll see better pictures of it in a minute. And it's gonna cost $200,000 unless you have the miles. Now this is the extraordinary thing that they unveiled at this press conference. These guys have been building this thing in secret since 2004. And well, actually they started a little later than that, but they had the idea to do this and wouldn't let anyone into the shop. Burt Rutan works very secretively. When he unveiled Spaceship One, he didn't tell anyone what he was building. He just invited a bunch of press over. He said, I'm going to unveil something. And people who were familiar with Burt Rutan knew that this was going to be cool, so they went. And Burt said, everything you see here is part of the first private manned space program. And he waved his arm and his curtain dropped away and he saw Spaceship One. I wasn't there. I wish I had been. But he likes to work in secret. He likes to build something behind closed doors, which he had been doing with this for several years. And then do this grand unveil of a working spaceship, a working airplane. Like with the Spaceship One rollout, he had his pilot get in, one of his pilots get into the White Knight, the carrier airplane that drops off the spaceship, and just fly it around over the heads of the people there, just to prove this wasn't a mock-up. But he's working now with Richard Branson, who wants to be very public and upfront about everything he's doing. So it's sort of this little bit of a personality clash. So Branson induced Rutan to come out and reveal what was going on behind closed doors, and this is it. This thing is gonna be 3 times bigger than Spaceship One. It's gonna have eight seats, 6 passengers and 2 pilots. And you can see the White Knight in the back. That's the carrier plane that dropped off Spaceship One. That's in the background. They're assembling Spaceship Two right here. And you can just see the size of this relative to the other one. Where, you know, saw the guy on top with the American flag. And this is much larger, obviously. And you can also see how easily they're lifting these pieces and moving them around. You couldn't do that with a metal construction with aluminum. It would just be too heavy. This is carbon fiber composite, which is what Burt Rutan has been working with all this time. And it's very, very strong and very, very light, which gives you the most boost for your rocket thrust. Someone asked me recently how they fasten these things together without rivets, you know, or welding. You know, I don't know the answer to that. But this is White Knight 2. This is not 2 aircraft. This is 1 aircraft. It has 2 fuselages that are connected together with a giant wing, as sort of like a unibrow or something. And it's hard to imagine his designs. You have to see them and I sort of puzzle over them. I can't quite clearly picture them unless I'm actually looking at them. Very strange airplanes. Rutan said this is the largest fully carbon fibered construction ever built for an airplane. And it's about the size of a B-29 bomber. It's going to have four jet engines on it. And one of the things I want to do with it is launch rockets from the bottom instead of the spaceship, too. They can put a rocket on the bottom and launch a satellite into orbit from there. But this is amazing to see this. I mean, you know, a lot of these companies roll out these models and they have these big unveils. Oh, yes, you've got a model. Okay, when's it going to fly? But to see that what's going on here behind the doors of the shop, people actually putting things together and getting ready to fly them. Now, this is the wing coming together now. They say they're going to test fly the White Knight 2 sometime this year, probably in the summer. And the spaceship, if all goes well, might fly by 2009, next year. And then the first paying passengers into space by 2010, which is also when Robert Bigelow is planning to launch his space station. And Elon Musk is planning to launch his passenger-carrying rockets into orbit. And the space shuttle is due to retire. So 2010 is going to be a pretty interesting year if all these things come together as they're expected to do. So that's what it looks like fully assembled. So this is the spaceship right here, riding in between. Now, this is all part of one airplane, the carrier plane, and this wing just goes across the spaceship. And the cabins are all identical, so that you can train for your space flight while you're riding the White Knight. You have the same cabin layout, and they're going to do parabolic flights to give you some time in zero gravity. You can get about 30 seconds that way or so. And it's quite a thing. And you can actually, they say you'll be able to see, people in here will be able to see the people in here. So you can kind of wave, you know, they're gonna have relatives in here or whoever. And you can wave, you know, wave back. And that's the spaceship after it's gotten into space. This is the distinguishing feature of Spaceship One and now Spaceship Two. The whole back of the airplane folds upward. And that's because I've told you before that the X-15 wiped out on reentry once and destroyed the aircraft and the pilot. And that was because they had to fly a very precise trajectory coming back in. You're going very high speed. If you hit the atmosphere the wrong way, you could shear a wing off, start to spin. The aerodynamic forces are too great for anything material that we can create. And the space shuttle, the same thing. The shuttle coming back flies a computer-controlled trajectory, partly for that reason. But Bert Rutan thought that's way too dangerous for passenger flight. His whole idea all along is if you want to have routine access to space, you've got to do it safely. You've got to have it be so that there isn't one chance in 60 you're going to blow up on any given flight, which is the shuttle safety record is not so great. So this is what he came up with. The hinging of the wings allows this thing, once it goes out of the atmosphere, the pilot hits a button and these motors bring it up. And then it can just fall at any configuration. He can be pointed upside down. He can be sideways. Anywhere he goes, the air is going to catch this high drag tail in the back and just write it. So it just writes itself. Bert Rutan calls that a carefree reentry. And then once he gets down low enough, he can hit the button, the booms come back down, click into place, and then it lands like a glider. Lands like a glider. That's Richard Branson's mother. And I met her 2 weeks ago, or I saw her, and she doesn't look like that anymore, but this is what you do. If you've seen the Virgin Atlantic airplanes, they all have these figureheads on the front, and these girls and things, and it's what they used to do on old ships, and now they're going to have them on the spaceships. And this logo is based around Richard Branson's eyeball. So now, also at the press conference 2 weeks ago, they released a video of an animation of what the entire flight will be like. So I'll run that, and then I'll interject a few comments here and there as we go.
Mm-hmm.
first flights will be out of Mojave, California, and then they're going to switch to New Mexico. They're building a spaceport out there called Spaceport America. And I caught Burger Cannon at an unguarded moment. Probably wouldn't even think there was any press in the room. He said, you know what, if I were a pastor, I wouldn't want to fly out of New Mexico and see what kind of crap you'd see out of New Mexico. I'm going to fly out of California and see the mountains and the ocean and all that. They're kind of pissed off in Mojave because New Mexico got lots and lots and lots of state money to build this fancy new spaceport, and these guys tinkering around out here in Mojave can't get anything from the government. But they're the ones who are actually doing this stuff and building it, making it fly. You see, everything takes off together. The two aircraft are mated together, and that's exactly how the X-15 would take off. Once you're inside, you'll see these indicators going around showing you how fast you're going, what your altitude is, and what your G-forces are. Take a couple hours just to get up to high altitude. They go up about 60,000 feet. And then just go into free fall. They're in free fall, weightless right now. And as soon as the engine shuts off, you're weightless, just like that, boom. And Brian Binney said this was just the most amazing part of the whole trip, the guy who won the X Prize. It's just, you know, you're hanging on, this thing is rattling and shaking, and you're, you know, 4 Gs on you, and boom, all of a sudden you're weightless, and there's no sound. And he said it's like crossing the threshold into another realm of existence. Seats will come down, and then you'll see in a minute they'll actually be able to open up their belts and float around in there. And they use a little compressed air thruster, is actually designed by Tim Pickens, the rocket bike guy, to spin around this slowly so you can see as much as possible. And you only have 4 minutes up here. So figure from the time this video begins to the end of it, that's as much time you have weightless looking at the Earth. The thing that's amazing to me to think about is this is the first time in history, this last two decades, when anyone has ever been able to actually leave our home environment and look back at it. It's sort of like fishes colonizing dry land from the ocean. It's that kind of importance in this incredible event, and it's happening within our lifetime. So they keep the feather up, they call that the feather, that hinging effect. They keep that up through the flight. They want to get it up as soon as possible when they get out of the atmosphere so they'll see right away whether there's a problem or not. Because once you're on that trajectory, the rocket motor has shut off. That's the only power the ship will ever have. They fire the rocket engine, that's it. They don't have any other engines. So they're just in a free fall trajectory. And at some point the pilot will get the ship more or less into a stable configuration, but again, it doesn't have to be perfect. And the question I had was, once you start re-entering, you're going to get up to 6 Gs. What if you don't get back in your seat? You know, what if you can't make it? And some of these folks are going to ride on this thing. They're pretty old. Richard Branson's dad's going to be on here. He's 89 now. But they say it's such a gradual buildup of G that apparently you will have plenty of time. Things will sort of gradually settle down. So you see the tail booms coming back down. Then it's just like a glider landing. So the space shuttle does is mostly computer controls, but these guys are all stick and rudder. You just have a stick and two rudder pedals, and just like Chuck Yeager did. Chuck Yeager, same thing, he had the stick and the rudders, and they're doing this again this way. So that's it for now. We'll see what happens.
Thank you. I've got a really simple, really prosaic, really boring question. There's a lot of junk in space. It's traveling a really, really high velocity. Bigelow's model deals with being hit with things in space. What kind of approaches are these companies using to deal with being hit in space? It's a really likely possibility that they'll be hit by something.
And the other half of this is what kind of environmental controls are being put in place, because there's a tremendous amount of pollution being created by this. The government can at least be regulated to a degree, but private industry isn't at all.
Those are good questions, and I don't know fully the answer to the space debris problem. I don't know that anyone does. The Bigelow, as you said, the Bigelow structure can take a certain number of hits of small particles, or even slightly larger objects. Right now, I don't think anyone has the answer. How are we going to, if we have lots of things going up there with people in them, how are we going to protect them that way? And the other question about the environmental impact of space travel, I mean, right now it's very small because there aren't very many launches, but if this does ramp up to the level of these folks hope to achieve, then you're going to have lots and lots of hydrocarbons burning up, going up into space. And the short answer is, well, they're not going to be able to do much about it right away. But down the line, Elon Musk hopes to fuel his ships with hydrogen. And there's a big if around that, though. The if comes in, it'll be environmentally friendly if we can create hydrogen without releasing greenhouse gases. Right now, hydrogen is created mostly from natural gas, and in the process releases a lot of carbon dioxide. So one plan, and Elon Musk subscribes to this idea, is you can take hydrogen from water through process of electrolysis, get electricity from solar power, and that's one of Elon Musk's businesses that he has going now, is a solar power business, and he thinks the future of electrical generation in the industrialized world is terrestrial-based solar power, as opposed to extraterrestrial solar power, which some folks think is a viable option also.
Okay, another question right over here.
So you mentioned that one in 60 was too often for everybody to die. Are the companies involved, are they talking about safety rates? Can you comment on that? What are they?
Yeah, they're very seriously looking at that issue. Someone like Richard Branson, he's got a lot riding on these things being safe and not killing his passengers. He's got this airline business going, and he's attaching his brand name to this space business, and it would not be good for either business to have a fatality with passengers on board. So at the same time, they have to acknowledge this is not going to be as safe as an airline. So the figure Burt Rutan gives is going to be 100 times safer than the early airlines. So, yeah, the early airlines are, I guess, were not noted for their safety, but 100 times, I'm not sure where he gets those figures, but the point is they're looking really seriously at this issue, and that's why he's got this carefree reentry system. He didn't want to build something unless he could solve at least that one problem that he had seen kill somebody before. So, okay, if we can solve the problem of having to reentry just precisely right, then, okay, that's one thing we've taken out of the risk factor.
It's a good question, and there were some fatalities already tied to that particular project.
Yeah, that's right. Last summer, we've had fatalities, just not in space or in flight yet. Last summer, there was an explosion at the Scaled Composites test facility in Mojave. And three Scaled Composites, this is Burt Rutan's employees, three of them were killed, three more put in the hospital. And right now, the spaceship development is more or less on pause while they figure out what happened. They still don't know what happened. They weren't test firing the engine. They were testing the nitrous oxide system. Remember, this is the rocket bike system. Started out, the idea is that you'd have a big bottle of nitrous oxide that flows oxidizer into the solid fuel and to allow it to burn. Apparently, no one has ever done this in the kind of quantities they're trying to do it with now, 10,000 pounds or something. And apparently, under certain conditions, certain kinds of heat, certain kinds of pressures, the oxidizer can just turn into a fireball, and that's apparently what happened. And so the government authorities are not treating this as a spaceflight accident or even a flight accident. They're treating it as an occupational safety problem. These guys are working with material they weren't properly trained in the use of. The problem is there's no one around who's got the experience to properly train these guys. And these are the sorts of problems that have to be worked out, and Branson and Rutan and the rest are very much aware of this. They've got to work this out before they put paying passengers on these ships. So this industry is precarious right now. It's at a point where it could just take off, just become the next big thing, or something else, or not. I'm an optimist. I think it is going to take off, but I think it's going to be a lot of bumps on the road. And Peter Diamandis, who founded the XPRIZE, I saw him at a conference once, perhaps unwisely, but proclaiming loudly, there will be fatalities. Yes, that's okay, he said, that's okay. People settled, the Wild West, and they had to get killed doing it. And you know, I thought, well, geez, that might be true, but I don't want to be one of those guys.
Okay, there was a question right down in the middle here.
I guess we're talking about propellants. Is this working still?
Yeah.
I noticed you're talking about different fuels that are going to take them out. What about different types of non-rockets to take them up into space? Is there any technology into that area?
Not that I know of. All the folks that I've been speaking with, they're basically using two different means of propulsion. One is some kind of air-breathing engine to get up to high altitude. And once you get high enough, the jet engines are not going to continue working. So that's sort of used to get the rocket up as high as it can go, so you don't have to carry as much rocket propellant. But then from then on, it's got to be some kind of reaction system. You know, propellants out the back, creating an equal and opposite reaction the other way to make the thing go to space. And as far as I know, no one's got anything else that will do the job. Different kinds of propellants to do that same job.
So let's hope that Popular Science and Wired give you $200,000 to go on the Virgin Galactic. In 4 minutes, what are you going to do?
Well, I'm with Rita Anderson, who was the first person to sign up with Rocket Plane. She said, I got 4 minutes. I don't want to be messing around with banging my head against the bulkhead and trying to get back into my seat. I want to see the view. Because you can get that weightless experience going on the Vomit Comet. You know, they call it the airplane that goes up and down. That's one of Peter Diamandis' new ventures. It's called G-Force One. You can actually buy a ride. I think it's about $4,000 now. And be weightless for about 30 seconds at a time. So you can get that weightless experience without going into space. So I'm with Rita Anderson. I want to see the view. As long as I can be by a window, I'm content to stay in place and watch it.
Okay, any other questions? No, I have a final question then, and that is, you've met these people, and these are as crazy as some of this seems, and wacky as some of the home-built products were that led them to the next steps. These people like Elon Musk, Richard Branson, others, these are deep, deep people. They're engineers, they're highly trained, they've been through all kinds of very famous business colleges. So they're attaching their names to this, they're attaching their future to this, their finances, everything. What is it that's motivating them, driving them, propelling them? Because there's other things they could be doing. This has to be the highest risk venture to put their name to compared to all the other activities they could be involved with. So you've met them. How do you put them into context?
It runs the gamut, but you're right. The successful business people know full well that this is a risky financial venture as well as any other kind of risk they're undertaking. And Robert Bigelow, who's building the commercial space station, he's from Las Vegas, he's a gambling man. He says 50-50 chance, he thinks. He's willing to take the gamble that his operation will work. Elon Musk says, well, I'm probably about 3 failed launches away from drying up all my money and not having enough customers to keep me going. So they've all got different motivations besides trying to make a buck. And that's partly what makes these very interesting people to spend time with, because you've got very capable, as you said, intelligent people who know about risk and just see what makes them tick. So for Tim Pickens on the rocket bike, well, he wants to feel what it's like to have a rocket stuck on the back of your bike. But you know, I mentioned Robert Bigelow. He feels our destiny is in space, that we can achieve, we can acquire knowledge in space that we can't down here on Earth. He's coming from the assumption that there are other beings out there that may well have been visiting us. So his theory, his idea is that, well, those other beings must have acquired the technology to cross these incredible interstellar distances by going into space in the first place. So he feels that if he puts these structures in orbit, researchers, scientists will be able to go up there and do some research and find new technologies that we could never have come up with under a gravity field. So that's Robert Bigelow. Elon Musk, you know, looks at the geological record and says, okay, well, 65 million years ago, most of life on Earth and the dinosaurs were wiped out, and what's our chance for this happening to us? And Stephen Hawking talks about this too, that, you know, the risk of an asteroid hitting Earth and wiping out civilization, you know, it may be too great a risk to endure, so let's get our eggs in another basket. So that's why Elon Musk wants to go to Mars. He feels that he's helping humanity to find another home planet. So all these people, and for Armadillo, John Carmack, the video game guy, does this on Tuesdays and Saturdays. He just wants a new technical challenge. This guy was the top of his field in video game programming. He figured out how to program first-person shooter games in a way that was very realistic on old PCs. You know, at the time they were top of the line, but you know, back in the early 90s when he was doing this, it was really hard to make a computer do a realistic shoot 'em up scene. So he figured out how to do these incredibly complex things with computers and video games, and how he wanted another challenge. He was always going for speed in these video games, and he built Ferraris in his spare time, and he souped them up, and he would do 200 miles an hour or something like that coming into work, and he wanted to go faster. So he saw the new challenge was in aerospace. And he was a self-taught programmer who was interested in programming and made a fortune doing it. Now he's a self-taught rocket designer. Tim Pickens, self-taught. A lot of these folks are self-taught. And they're looking for new challenges. So there's a range of reasons for this activity.
Okay. So on that note, I'd like to thank our guest for coming today and sharing his passions and joy and the research on the private rocketeers. I'd like to thank Michael Buffett.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.